We are going to continue with Pirkei Avos. Okay, now we're up to the fourth Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, the first chapter. Yossi ben Yoezer is Treda, the Yossi ben Yochanan is Yerushalayim Kiblu Mehem. Yossi ben Yoezer is Treda. Whenever it says that in Pirkei Avos or in other places also, it means that simply that he came from the city of Treda. And up until not too long ago, that's how they define people or identified them. This one came from Mir, and this one came from Radner, and whatever. And many names that we have, last names, come from names of cities. I'm sure Ratner comes from Radner, or Volozhin is from Chaim Volozhiner. His last name wasn't Volozhiner, he came from Volozhin. And so on. And many great, great Gedolim of even the past generation were originally known from by the name of their place. The Yeshiva Bachim were known from where they came from. So that's the simplest. Yossi ben Yoezer, Ish Treda. But the fact that it says Ish means also a very prominent person. He was the most prominent person in that place. And that place was famous because of him. So that's Ish Treda. And Yossi ben Yochanan Ish Yerushalayim. So they were the next in line of the tradition, those responsible to pass on the oral tradition. And these started what's called the Zugos, the pairs. Till now we had individuals. Now, in each generation, there were a pair of Gedolei Yisrael who functioned together as the transmitters of Torah Shebaal Peh. The first was the Nasi. He was the leader of the Jewish people in Bavel, in Eretz Yisrael, in Nasi. And the second was the Av Beis Din. He was the head of the Sanhedrin. They worked together. The Nasi was more or less the political leader, but the political leaders were the Talmidei Chachamim. They weren't separate political leaders. The great Talmidei Chachamim led the people. And the Av Beis Din was the head of the Sanhedrin. So Yossi ben Yoezer was the Nasi, and Yossi ben Yochanan was the Av Beis Din. These Zugos had something also unique about them, that the Gemara says, that the first arguments that ever came up in Klal Yisrael, not that there weren't other arguments before that, but the arguments were always settled immediately by bringing it to the Sanhedrin. And they never remained a point of discussion. They were brought to the Sanhedrin, they discussed it, they voted, and that wasn't a popular vote, it was a vote of the greatest Gedolim of the time who sat together, discussed it together, and came to a conclusion. And after that conclusion, everybody had to agree, and if somebody disagreed and went and in certain situations, certain kinds of laws, taught that something else should be done besides what the Sanhedrin decided, he was a Zaken Mamre and he was liable to a death penalty. So there weren't any ongoing arguments, halachic arguments in Klal Yisrael. The first halachic argument that did not, for whatever reason, reach a settlement was whether it was a rabbinic halacha, it wasn't even a Torah law, whether you are someich on an animal that you bring as a sacrifice on Yom Tov. You could bring certain sacrifices on Yom Tov. Somech means that you laid your hands on the animal, and in that way, the idea of smicha, one of the ideas is that you identify with the animal. Since one of the ideas of the sacrifice is that what happens to the animal you vicariously feel is happening to you, by giving over the animal to God and burning it on the altar and sacrificing it to God, you feel that you're getting closer to God through that animal. So in order to feel the connection to the animals, a din of smicha. Smicha wasn't just lightly putting your hands on the animal, but with all your force, leaning down on the top of the animal to really feel that connection between you and the animal. And since the rabbis prohibited having physical connection with animals on Shabbos and Yontif are muktzah. So you're not allowed to move them or support yourself on them. So if you make smicha, you are transgressing that rabbinic prohibition. So there was an argument whether that rabbinic prohibition was waived for the halacha of smicha, or it wasn't waived for that. And this argument went down for generations. These zugos, each one in each generation held a different side of the argument. In most generations, the Nasi held this way, the Abdesin held that way. Sometimes the Abdesin held the first way, and the Nasi held the other way. But this argument went on for generations and was not resolved till generations later. And each generation, the heads of the generation, argued about this point. So this is the beginning again of the Zugos, the pairs of the Nasi and the Av Beis Din, who are the transmitters of Torah Shebaal Peh. Now, Yossi ben Yoezer, who we are going to learn what he said, was a very special person. He was a Kohen, and he was known as the Chosid Shebe Kohuna. He was a very, very pious person. A Chosid, in the common vernacular, is somebody who wears a Shaimel on Shabbos or whatever, but that's not the kind of Chosid we're talking about. Could be somebody who wears a Shaimel on Shabbos also was that kind of Chosid. But Chosid then meant a person who was known to go beyond the letter of the law, both between man and God and between man and man. When it came between man and man, he was willing to forego what belonged to him or what was rightfully his for others. And between man and God, he went beyond the letter of the law and was extra strict in his observance of the Torah. That was what is called a chosid. And he was called the chosid shebe kohuna. And it says that from the time that he was a youth till the time that he left this world, he did not sin, except for one thing that the Gemara mentions, and that is also rabbinic halacha. The rabbis prohibited raising small animals in Eretz Yisrael. Small animals means like goats and sheep and things like that. And only large animals like cows and oxen and could be raised. Why? What? Right, behema daka. Right, that's a small animal, whatever it's called. Why? Because those animals grazed in other people's. It's hard to control them, and they basically led their owners to steal. So they prohibited megadol behema daka. It was prohibited in Eretz Yisrael because it ruined the pasture land or whatever. So he had a medical condition where he needed to have goat's milk. And he had to have fresh goat's milk. So he had a goat that was tied to his bed, and he got fresh goat milk every day from that to deal with his medical condition, Yossi ben Yoezer. And once he became sick, and the rabbis came to visit him. And when they saw the goat, they said that somebody who has, theft in their house, we can't visit. And that was the only sin that he had, that he transgressed a rabbinic prohibition because of health reasons. Okay. It says that when Yossi ben Yoezer left this world, batlu ho eshkolos. He was the last of the eshkolos. Now some say eshkolos, the word eshkol means a bunch of grapes, right? A cluster, that's what it means, a cluster. The clusters were lost. So what does that mean? Some say it means that he gathered together many, many Gedolei Yisrael and used to learn and teach in groups. Those groups no longer existed. He was able to bring together a lot of different people, and when he died, that Mila died with him. Others say that it means just like the clusters of grapes protect the grapes, they all are in a cluster so they protect each other, so too he protected his generation. And the people that could protect the generation at the caliber of Yossi ben Yoezer didn't exist anymore. And lastly, Isho Eshkolos can mean Isha HaKolbo, which Lahavdol Elef Havdolim is similar to what is called a Renaissance man. Okay, only in similarity. That's not what Isho Eshkolos, but that is a similarity. Somebody who not only was great in one regiment, but was great all around, in every area of wisdom and character, whatever. That's Isho Eshkolos, a person shahakol bo. Everything exists within him. Rabbi Yossi ben Yoezer was the last of those kind of individuals. About it, there were great individuals after him. But of the caliber that he represented, it was the end of an era. Okay. Now, so that is a little bit about Yossi ben Yoezer. Now, the Mishnah, it says, Yossi ben Yoezer, Ish Tzreda, the Yossi ben Yochanan, Ish Yerushalayim, Kiblu Mehem. Now, if you look in the Mishnah before, who was the transmitter of Torah Shebaal Peh, the generation before? Antigonus Isocho, who was one person. It should have said, Kibel Mimenu. They received from him, not from them. So the Abarbanel, everything I'm telling you now is in the Abarbanel. That is what we made up, that we are going to first learn the Abarbanel, and then we will branch out to other things. So till now, everything I've told you basically is found in the Abarbanel, with a little few exceptions. In any case, so the Abarbanel says that either that they received not just from Antigonus Isocho, but they also received from Shimon HaTzadik. They were already students of Shimon HaTzadik, not only of Antigonus Isocho. So they received from Shimon HaTzadik and Antigonus Isocho, and because of that, they went back and explained, helped to continue explaining what the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah said, what Shimon HaTzadik said. What did Shimon HaTzadik say? That the world exists on Torah, Avoda, and Gemilus HaSodim. So Antigonus Isocho already explained Avoda, right? Don't be like slaves who serve the master in order to get a reward. That's Avoda. Yossi ben Yoezer now is going to explain Torah, and Yossi ben Yochanan is going to explain Gemilus Chasodim. So they enhanced what Shimon HaTzadik said, because they not only received from Antigonus Isocho, they also received from Shimon HaTzadik, and that's why it says Kiblu Mehem. Okay. Now, so what did he say? Now let's see the Mishnah. He said the following. Yossi ben Yoezer Omer. Yossi ben Yoezer said the following. Yehi beischa beishvad lechachomim. Your house should be a meeting place for the chachomim, for the sages. The heve misabek ba'afar agleihem. Simplest meaning, misabek means you should wallow in the dust of their feet. In other words, sit at their feet and roll in the dust of their feet. They have a shosa bitzoma es divrehem, and drink with thirst what they say. So again, let's see first what the Abar Benel says about this, and then we'll see what others say. He says like this, that first of all, like we said, he comes to enhance and enlarge and expound on what Shimon HaTzadik said, that the world exists on Torah, Avoda, and Gemilas HaSodim. He came to expound on Torah. How can you really perfect the pillar of Torah by making your home a place of the meeting place of the wise? And by thirstily drinking of their words and by sitting at their feet, meaning humbling yourself before them. Three things. One is be around Chachamim as much as you can and open your home to them. Secondly, humble yourself before them. Thirdly, drink with thirst, with interest, what they have to say. Those three things put together will enable you to reach the perfection of Torah. Now he says like this, that which a person makes his home a meeting place for the wise, he says that this will lead you to be able to acquire the Torah in its perfection with one condition, or two conditions. There's a very big mila of constantly being around Talmidei Chachamim. We'll see that some say that even if you're not on a level to actually learn from them, because you're not, but you'll pick up something here, pick up something there. They're around all the time. In addition, you'll be able to learn from their character, from their actions, not just from what they say. So you will be constantly surrounded with wisdom and with wise people who you can learn from. But there's a danger in that, because familiarity breeds contempt, meaning the following. If you become too familiar with these Chachamim, then you begin, and you're the one, they're in your house, you begin to think you're the Bala boss and they're your guests. And you begin to look down on them because they're in your house, right? They need you. And also, because you're familiar with them all the time, you lose interest. You know, something that's unusual, you're interested in. Something you have all the time takes away the interest, becomes habitual. So those two dangers exist. If you're going to open your home to the wise, you may begin to think that you're there in your home, they need you, so you won't humble yourself before them. And also you'll get bored with what they have to say because it'll be commonplace. Won't be something special. So on that, the Mishnah continues and says that even though you will open your home as a meeting place for the wise, but you sit in the dust of their feet, think that you're the guest and they're the balabatim. Because what they benefit you by being in your home is a lot more than you benefit them by giving them the access to your home. What you're giving them is nothing compared to what they're giving you. So don't think you're the Bala boss. Don't get carried away with the fact that you're the guy who has these chachamim. Still humble yourself before them. And don't get used to it, but drink thirstily what they have to, as if you're thirsty. Because when a person drinks when he's thirsty, the drink is a lot more refreshing than when you drink and you're not really interested. So drink the waters of Torah they have with tremendous desire and interest, even though it's available to you all the time, and the danger is that it's going to become commonplace. And he says, the Abar Benel, that we learn from this the following things. First, that Yehi Beis Chabad Vad L'Chachamin, right, means that you should make your home fit to be a place for the Chachamim to meet and to learn Torah. That implies that a place where you learn Torah should be clean, should be a place that, what's it called, that promotes wanting to have wisdom because of its physical nature. Right? It should be the kind of place that people associate with purity, with wisdom, and shouldn't be the kind of place you associate with something else. Right? You're not going to bring your Talmidei Chachamim into a place that looks like a casino. I remember somebody I once knew decorated his living room or whatever with all kinds of things that looked like a either a pinball parlor or a bar. That's not the place that Talmidei Chachamim are going to come and make a Beis Medrash. But if you make it a clean, nice place that accommodates sitting and learning Torah, right? Then that's the kind. It doesn't have to be gaudy. It doesn't have to be rich. It can be simple. But it should be a place that is fit for sitting and learning Torah. A place where you learn Torah should be prepared, the Rabbi Arbenel says, with purity, right? It's like a small mikdash, place where you daven, has to also be a place that is conducive to feel holiness and purity. The same thing the place where you learn. They are considered like a small mikdash, small temple, and just like the Beis HaMikdash had those things in it that were conducive to purity and holiness, so too, if you're opening your home to Talmidei Chachamim and you want them to come and gather, make it the kind of place that they'll feel comfortable being, because it bespeaks purity and holiness. We find the same thing with Elisha and the Shunamis, this great woman who Elisha passed through Shunem often, and she prepared a special room for him with a table and a bed where he could feel at home and also feel that this is a place that is conducive to being a prophet. Right? Okay. Okay. Second thing that we learned, so that's the first thing we learned. Since it says, make your home a meeting place of the Chachamim, it's not going to work just to put up an invitation, come to my home. They have to feel comfortable there, and Chachamim aren't going to feel comfortable to make your home a place where they learn Torah unless it's conducive to learning Torah. So it implies in the Mishnah that you have to do something to make a place conducive to learning Torah. Second thing, how fortunate a person is that his home should be chosen to be the meeting place of Talmidei Chachamim. He should feel honored honored, and he should feel that it's his benefit. He shouldn't feel that he's doing somebody a favor by letting the Chachamim come into his house. That we learn from the fact that you should sit at their feet as if you're the guest and they're the balabatim. Why? Because like we said, the Abarbanel says, what you benefit them by giving them a place to be physically is nothing compared to what they benefit you by bringing all that Torah into your home. So instead of you feeling the big shot, the Bala boss, I'm doing these people a favor, feel they're doing you a favor, right? Feel the benefit that you get, and therefore sit at the dust of their feet. Thirdly, he says that you should, if you feel like that, then you should honor the Chachamim, right, and treat them like they are the balabos and that you're the guest, okay? Like he says, because the benefit is more yours than theirs. So therefore you should feel how fortunate it is to be around Talmidei Chachamim, and that should lead you to humble yourself before them. And lastly, how important it is that the Torah should be always sweet and interesting and not become commonplace. And that is what Chazal say. Few places, and we will go into great detail about that at some later point in this Mishnah. B'chol yom yu b'necha kechadoshim. One of the places that we learn that from is in Kriya Shema. V'hoyu hadvarim ho'eile asher anochi mitzavecho hayom al levavecha. Here it says you should not say that pasuk and put the comma in the wrong place, because you can read it the following way: Asher avahayu hadvarim ho'eila shanochi mitzavecha hayom alavavecha. What I command you should be today on your heart. meaning not tomorrow, just temporarily, today. That's not the way to read it. But Asher Anochi Mitzavecho Hayom, that which I am commanding you today, should always be on your heart. So why does it say today? Because Torah should not become something old, something to get used to, something that just becomes habit. But Hayom, every day should be like the Torah was given that day. And we'll see that that applies not only to learning Torah, it applies to doing mitzvahs, it applies to a host of other things also. But Torah is kept best when it's exciting. And we know that things that are new, you feel more excited about. A Yom Tov that comes once a year is exciting. Something you do every single day becomes commonplace, and you don't put the same interest into it, right? But you should. Say Kriya Shema twice a day, every day. It's a mitzvah from the Torah. No less than lulav or esrog or shofar or matzah or whatever, but that only comes once a year. So those we're really excited about, and we were careful every detail or whatever. And yet Kriya Shema is a mitzvah comes every single day, twice a day, and people don't get as excited and aren't as careful with it as other mitzvahs that do not come so often. So therefore the danger is that if something becomes commonplace and habitual, that you'll lose your interest in it and you won't really relish it. And the more that a person is interested in what he's doing, the more he's going to do it properly and do it with emotion and with carefulness or whatever. So therefore, the fourth lesson, the Barbanel says from this Mishnah, is that you should drink the words of the Chachamim thirstily. Have thirst for it. Be interested in it. Right? Desire it. Don't just take it because they're around, so you get used to it. Okay. One last thing the Abarbanel says is another pshat in this Mishnah, a more conceptual pshat. He says, Beischa can be your mind. Open your mind to the Chachamim, meaning people sometimes get into preconceived notions, ideas that they harbor for whatever reason, and they're not open-minded enough to hear other opinions. And you don't learn like that, because then you're set in your ways, you're set to one thing, and you're not interested in hearing other opinions, or maybe what you thought is wrong. And you're willing to hear maybe that there's questions on it, or opposition to it, or reason why you should think something different. So yehi beischa beisvad lechachamim. Let your mind be a meeting place of the mind. Be open. Open your mind to other opinions, others than the ones that you have become accustomed to. And what's it called? And because of that, right, listen and be humble. Be humble. That misabik batragleim. Be humble to the opinions of people greater than you. So we're not talking about opening your house, we're talking about opening your mind, says the Abarbanel, to other opinions other than the ones that you have been accustomed to, and be humble that to accept that maybe you're making a mistake, maybe you were wrong, and maybe these other opinions of the wise are more correct than what you thought to begin with. And the Yishteh, the Tzoma is Divreya, meaning the following. And when you have doubts, you don't know everything. If you don't open your mind to ideas that are beyond you, you're going to be constantly in doubt and not know clearly what things are. You're going to be in doubt in halacha, you don't know this halacha, you don't know that halacha, you're in doubt in hashkafa, I don't know if this is what I'm supposed to believe or that I'm supposed to believe. If you don't open your mind to the ideas of people greater than you, you're going to have a lot of questions without answers. But if you open your mind and you drink thirstily, right, what they have to say, it will solve your problems by answering your questions and resolving your doubts. And he says another idea is when you drink thirstily, so a person drinks, if he drinks too much, too quickly, he chokes. So drink bitsama, drink in a way that it will quench your thirst. Don't take in too much, more than you can handle. which I want to expound on a little bit. You're going to have these chachamim around, people of great stature, and you're going to begin to think that you can copy them and do whatever they're doing. And you can just open your mouth and swallow all the wisdom they have when you're not holding by that. A person has to know, on the one hand, he has to want to constantly improve, constantly be around greater people than him and aspire to be great as they are, and learn as much as he can. That's one true. That's true. At the same time, a person has to recognize what he's capable of doing and what not. And you can't jump up the stairs. You have to want to climb the stairs and get to the top. And if you're around great people, right, they give you the incentive to want to be like that, especially if you're around them. Because, I'll go off a little bit on a tangent here, one of the ways of engendering an incentive to grow is to learn about greater people than you. And then you get a desire to be like them. Because if you don't know that there's greater levels than you, then what? There's nothing to desire. You think you've made it. You're the greatest. But if you understand there are greater people than you, so it therefore helps to read books about Gedolei Yisrael or great women, right? And Baruch Hashem today, there are plenty of books written, right, about great people, about Tannoyim, Amoroyim, great Gedolim of past generations or current Gedolim or whatever. And it used to be there didn't be so many books, but there was plenty of stories that people would tell about whatever. And Gedolim do tell these stories because it gives people an incentive to want to aspire to be like these people with one condition. There are two kinds of books about Gedolim. Some books portray these people as superhuman people who never did anything wrong, who from the time they were born were geniuses and saints. And if that's the way the Gadol is portrayed, then it's interesting. Those books are very interesting, but they're like comic books. You read about Superman, Batman, right? I remember when I was a kid. So you may be inspired by them, but you're never going to want to be them, at least not when you get a little bit older. My mother told me, Aleha Shalom, that when I was a little kid, I used to put a towel around my neck and think I could fly. But Baruch Hashem, I quickly realized that that's not going to be, even with a towel around my neck, right, like Superman, and I didn't try doing it out the window. So I'm still here to tell you about it. But in any case, when a person gets somewhat mature, he realizes he's not going to be Superman or Batman. It's very nice fiction. It's very nice something to entertain you. So if you look at Gedolei Yisrael like that, then it's very entertaining, but there's not too much value in it. And there are many books written like that. The emes is, Rav Huttner says this, somebody once told him, a boy wrote him, he was already 18, 19, 20, and he said he doesn't think he's going to leave the Beis Medrash. He's not going to sit and learn anymore because he really feels he'd never be a Gadol b'Yisrael because he's done too many things wrong and he has too many trials and tribulations and he's not tzaddik material. So he's just giving up. So Rav Huttner wrote him a long letter saying, do you think that these Gedolim never had trials and tribulations? They never had the Yetzer Hara. They didn't have to. They became Gedolim because they fought and they worked. Not that they were born perfect. Nobody's born perfect. If they are, that's not the purpose of being in this world. So if these Gedolim are portrayed as human beings who had a Yetzer Hara, who also failed sometimes, who also were regular human beings, but look what a regular human being can do, then you can gain something from this. But if they're portrayed like angels from the time that they were born, then you can read books about angels too, but I'm not going to be Gavriel or Michael or Raphael. Right, it's very nice. But I could be, right, according to my potential, like people that I see are human beings, and look how great a human being can be. When I first came to Eretz Yisrael, we came as tourists for 3 weeks, and we toured the country ourselves. My wife and myself had never been here. My shul sent me here because that year there was a breakaway shul. The community only had one frum shul for many, many years. And I was the rav of that shul for quite a few years. And it was one shul. Everybody davened in one shul. But as communities grow, that is a fact of life, that there's always a breakaway shul. And, the famous shul that I daven in, and this is the one I don't daven in. And there's something to that. There's something to that. When that breakaway took place, what happened was, right after a Simchas Torah, Shabbos Bereishis, we noticed about 10, 11 families are not in the shul. People are not in the shul. And the word got out that these 11 families decided they're starting another shul, they're davening in somebody's house, and they are starting the seeds of a new shul. So you can imagine being a young rabbi of a shul, and there was only one shul, and now 11 people, pulled away from the shul, partially because they weren't happy with the political leadership of the shul, partially they weren't happy with the rabbi. They wanted a shul that was more to the left, whatever that means.
User-friendly.
Well, no, not user-friendly. They felt that the shul was too frum. It was, we were a young Israel. So they wrote the National Council of Young Israel and said that they should take away our charter because we're too frum to be a young Israel. But the young Israel did not appreciate that. The rabbi was not Zionistic enough and didn't speak about Israel enough, and these people wanted something more Zionistic, more modern Orthodox, whatever that means. We didn't go around and drove a car, so I was modern in that way. I didn't go in an Amish, a wagon with a horse. But in any case, so for some reason, it was not modern Orthodox. So the they split away from the shul, and I don't know why I'm telling you this. It has nothing to do with what I wanted to tell you about Eretz Yisrael. But in any case, okay, it's interesting because I'll tell you something about Yaakov Kamenetsky said. So as a young hot-headed rabbi, right? These people were destroying the unity of the community, and I felt like Pinchas, I should get a spear and just spear them through. And one of my balabatim, who himself was a kanoi, this guy was more hot-headed than I was, but when it's in somebody else is involved, you see things more clearly when you're involved. He came to me, and he said to me, "Rabbi, do me a favor. Don't react to this until you speak to Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, who happened to be in Miami at the time. He spent his winters, and I had a connection with him." So he said, "Speak to Rabbi Yaakov first before you react to this." So Motzei Shabbos, I went to Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, and I told him, what happened, what a chutzpah, 11 people pull away from the shul, starting their own shul. This is a community, was one shul for years and years. They're destroying the unity of the shul, of the community. So Yaakov said, "Look, I'm an old man." He said, "You're a young guy. You probably want to spear them through." He said, "I'm going to tell you something. It's not going to be easy to do, but I'm telling you this is what you should do. And I'm begging you to listen to me." He said to me, "Now, you can't please everybody. Never. And therefore, there has to be another place for people to go. It's not healthy for a community to only have one place where everybody feels they're forced to be in a place that maybe they're not happy." And then he told me the following. He said, "The Alter from Slabodka said that a house that doesn't have a Beis HaKiseh, the whole house stinks. You need a place for the psolus to go, for the waste to go. Vanela, you can't make everybody happy, so the people who aren't happy, give them a place to go. Help them. Give them a Sefer Torah if they need it. If it's Yontif, send them Kohanim so they could have Duchening. Whatever they need, help them to get established. One thing," he said, "never let them back into your shul." That's what he told me. That's what he said. "Never let them back into your shul. They're finished. Wish them luck. That's healthy. He said, the healthiest thing is there should be a place for people who are dissatisfied to be, not by you. So, and the truth is, that's what I try to do at least. And that shul, Baruch Hashem, grew, and our shul grew. Both shuls grew. Eventually, they had to get a rabbi. So, to spite themselves, they couldn't get a rabbi less from than me, because how would that look? So they got a very fine rav, Rabbi Sprung, who was a son-in-law to Rabbi Weinberg from Ner Yisrael. And he, what's it called, in certain places was firmer than me. We got along great, and that really bothered them. In any case, and then I left, and by that time already, when I came back to Miami, I spoke in that shul. Right? There were two people who never walked into that. The president of the shul at the time that it split never walked into that shul, and my wife. They were the last stronghold of people who wouldn't walk into that breakaway shul. Most of the people in Miami didn't know there was a breakaway shul. They came to a place. It was two shuls. And I remember after I left Miami, I went back there, and the first place I spoke was in that shul, which was very, I said, very ironic. Most of you have no idea how significant this is. I even spoke about Sholem and Machlokas. And then, when that rabbi left, they needed another rabbi, and a very, very close friend. When I was in Miami, Rabbi Mordechai Shapiro was the Rav of the major shul of Miami Beach. He was a Talmud of Rav Aaron Cutler, and I was a young, raw rabbi, and he was my mentor. So I was very, very close with him and his family, and I knew his children as they grew up, and his son, he had been nifter, and his son, I got into that shul. So now he's the Rav, Rabbi Ephraim Shapiro. He's a world-famous Rav. He speaks all over, whatever, young guy, Ephraim Shapiro. And he is the Rav now of that shul, which is very interesting. So I'm the one who got the rabbi in there, and the one who's there now. So in any case, now there's about 15 shuls in that community. When I left, my shul split again, and one part of the shul went one way, and the other part stayed where it was, like an amoeba, constantly splitting. In any case, now there's about 15 shuls in the community, and they're all thriving. It's a big place, North Miami Beach, and Baruch Hashem, I'm here. And there's still only one shul in Matityahu, and I'm hoping they won't hear this tape. In any case, it's a different situation. I'm too old for that now. In any case, why did I tell you this? Because that year, my shul said, Rabbi, you went through a difficult year, you and your wife, and you need a rest. So we're going to kill two birds with one stone. You've never been in Eretz Yisrael. We're going to send you to Eretz Yisrael, pay your expenses. We had eight children at the time. They farmed our children out and amongst the community. You and your wife go for 3 weeks, rest up, and maybe you'll come back more Zionistic because you'll be in Eretz Yisrael for 3 weeks. That was one of the complaints. So we came here and we decided we're not going to go on organized tours. We're going to go, that doesn't mean you should not go on organized tours, and our Tseinu tours is one of the organized tours that you should go on. But we decided we're going to do it on our own. And we took Egged buses all over the country, and have a lot of stories to tell, but not now, about that. But in any case, after about 5-6 days of this, my wife turns to me, and she says, every place we have visited so far, except for the Kosov, is a grave. Morris HaMachpelah, Kever Rochel, Rabbi Akiva's grave, Sfas, all the graves. All we've been doing is visiting graves. Why are the Mekomos HaKdoshim in Eretz Yisrael graves? Why can't we go see Rabbi Akiva's Beis Medrash? Why are the places of Kedusha the graves of these people? Graves are usually a place that's Tamei. Why is the Makom, if you think about it, every place it's a Makom Kodesh, except for the Koso, is graves. So I thought about it, and another thing bothered me. That is, I understood the first time I'm in Eretz Yisrael, I want to go right away to the Kosel. So my brother-in-law, who lived here, my wife's brother, they lived at the time in Gush Etzion, in Kfar Etzion. So I told him, look, I want you to pick me up from the airport. I want you to take me directly from Ben-Gurion to the Kosel. First thing I want to do is daven mincha by the Kosel. So he did. And I had a Bala boss who was a sailor in his youth. He was a Bal Tshuva, very gross person, but very, very, very emotional person. And he came back from Eretz Yisrael once, and he told me that when he came to the Kosel, his heart started beating very fast. He thought he was going to faint. He was, like, you know, ecstatic in a different world. So I said, wow, this guy, when he went to the Kosel, felt like that. I'm going to have to call Hatzola, you know, to come with me to the Kosel. Who knows what I'm going to feel? So my brother-in-law took me to the Kosel. I didn't feel anything. It was a wall. I daven mincha like I daven mincha any other time. And I really felt guilty. I said, maybe, Bill, I got to check. Maybe I'm not Jewish. What, you know, what in the world is... I didn't feel anything. And afterwards, with my wife's question, I spoke it over with my shiver of gifters, that's out, came to the following conclusion. I had been expecting the Kosel to be something elevated off the ground, like about 5 feet, floating in the air, with sparks flying from it, and it was a regular wall. In addition, I was really shocked in Yerushalayim. I thought people would be walking around in robes with donkeys or whatever, and there were cars and red lights and modern buildings. You get this feeling that it can't be holy unless it's like somewhere a different world. And when you see it's this world, then it's a rude awakening. And the same thing with Gedolim. You know what makes a Gadol great? That he's a human being. And look what a human being can accomplish. Because if he was a Malach, big deal. Malachim are made to be like that. And the proof that he's a human being is that he's buried there. He's flesh and blood, just like you. And look what flesh and blood could do. That's why the Mekomos HaKadoshim are graves. Because that's what really shows that that Gadol was a Gadol. Look what a human being, who's flesh and blood, who dies just like everybody else, and is buried there like everybody, look what he could accomplish. If he can, you can be like an angel, even though you're not an angel. But if you are an angel, no big deal. But if you're like an angel, it's a different story. So those books, and therefore, you have to understand the greatness of the Kosel, of the base. It's a plain wall. But look what that wall, that plain brick stone wall, can be holy. Now, it doesn't have to be elevated in the air with the sparks and what's it called, light coming from it. Its greatness is that it's a stone wall that's infused with Kedusha. That's the greatness. And the same thing over here. So therefore, books that portray Gedolim as angels who never sinned, who never had any, and were great and geniuses from the time they were born, those books are entertaining. But read Superman, it's much more entertaining. But if the books that portray Gedolim as real people, but look what kind of real great people they can be. I remember after Moshe Feinstein, we'll end with this. After Moshe Feinstein was nifter, so the books came out or whatever that said fantastic things about him. He finished Shas 400 times. Or what. So one of his relatives wrote and said he doesn't understand why they have to write these fantastic stories about his relative Reb Moshe. And things that obviously never happened, and he never did. There are so many things that he did do that those you should write. In fact, why don't you say how he used to hold his grandchildren on his knee and how he's such a great grandfather? That's what you should say. He was a regular human being, and yet he was Reb Moshe Feinstein. Don't portray him as somebody superhuman that nobody could learn anything from because it's impossible to do whatever what supposedly he did. And he didn't do it either. But still, look at the great person, and he was a human being. He was a person who was warm. He was a person who cared for his children and grandchildren. And yet, he was the Gadol Hador. That's the way to portray a Gadol.
Yeah. In 1970, my first trip to Israel with early children and my two youngest kids. When I got to the kosher, I don't know why all of a sudden I started crying. My daughter Jewish was 8 years old. Mommy, what's the matter? Why are you crying? I was so overwhelmed. Then I said, gave me the privilege of touching them.
Okay, so you're probably in a higher madriga than me, but it took me a while. By the time we left, I did feel like that. Yeah.
So I'm coming to the shooting to almost 25 years. She had a 25 year anniversary. And my whole community thing is calling in. It's all I want to do, and you can learn no matter what I had to do. When I got to the title, first time I heard you tell that story, it made me feel like I'm a room for me. Because I thought, what's wrong with me? I brought it through the wall. Also, the problem, one of the problems in the Shidokan is girls think that they're going to marry.
Nine. They don't realize that the people written in the book are 80 years old, and they weren't like that when they were 19. If they want to marry an 80-year-old, something's really wrong with them. Okay.